A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Shall it be Queen Karen? It's time for Must Have CTV, the podcast dedicated to the sitcoms of the 20th century from I Love Lucy to News Radio. Sometimes we do dramas. I'm your TV guide, Brett White, and I'm also a senior reporter producer for Decider.com, and you also sometimes a drag queen named Barb Hardley. Say hello to the killer to my stone, Ethan Kay. Hello, Ethan.
Hello, Brett. I just noticed that for the two episodes that we've done dramas, you've been Brett.
Oh, maybe that's
fun. Comedies, you are Barb.
Yeah, or it's just being timed to when I am emotionally unable to spend the time to get into drag.
Because sometimes dramas can take a lot out of you, and it's you know, they're usually an hour long. Where we usually watch sitcoms. Sitcoms 20 some minutes. It through that, you know, you get an A plot, a B plot, and an end credit sting, and you're done.
I was considering doing, like, getting into drag during the episode, like doing my makeup while we talk, and then at the end I'd be in drag. That could be something at some point. That could be a fun YouTube exclusive. Pride Month. We're very prideful. I don't know.
in the good way, not the seven deadly sins way.
No, I'm the seven deadly sins way. Because I'm prideful in the gay way, so therefore deadly sin. What are you watching?
It's right a solid now? Question. A lot of stuff has some stuff's come back. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia just came back, and every episode is fantastic. Mm-hmm. But if we want to introduce people to new stuff, I would say that there's an animated show on Crunchyroll called X Plus Y, which is a creepy psychological thriller about a guy who goes to an escape room and suddenly finds his entire life has turned into an escape room. And it's the episodes are short. They're only about 16, 17 minutes long. It's animated from China. And it is just it's a very good drama. And creepy, and it's very well done, and it's the one this anime season that I'm like, let's watch X Plus Y, let's watch that.
And how many episodes will there be total? Is it one of those where there'll be like 500 episodes in 1 year?
It doesn't seem like that, because right now it's the first season, and they are short, and they're only doing 12 episodes as far as I can tell, because I've tried to look it up to see if they're doing longer things or second season, and you would not believe how many businesses there are called X Plus Y or X and Y or
Kyle XY from ABC Family.
So I can't find a lot of information about the show other than it is on. It seems like they just finished kind of like a mini story arc, but I can't imagine that the show would end on that. So I'm like, fingers crossed for a 24 episode season or a 2-part season.
Yeah.
But what are you watching? I mean, you watch everything.
I mean, in terms of things that I'm liking and not covering, all of season 2 of The Bear came out on Thursday on FX instead of doing a weekly drop like they did for season 1. It's all out at once. And so therefore, which I binged the first season after it all aired. So, you know, this is how I'm used to it. But yeah, I've watched the first 6 episodes, and it is an intense emotional journey. It's so it's filling the Mad Men void in a way of like, I loved Mad Men because it was about people who were good at their jobs and like that mattered to them. And like the camaraderie you forge with people at a job doing a thing, it was like very moving to me as someone who's, I don't know, like, I don't have children. I'm not going to get anything out of a family drama. Like I get nothing. I'm soulless. I'm heartless. No,
but you know, but workplace. Like, you
yeah, workplace. Yeah. So like the Bear this season, they're rebranding and rebuilding the restaurant. And so just like watching this ragtag group of people who like last season didn't get along and have gone through so much stuff and are now like really trying to like pull together to do something bigger than even the sum of all their parts is so emotional and cool. And yeah, and it also has a lead character who deals with anxiety and PTSD. So I really, really appreciate that. And it only comes into more sharper contrast or sharper, starker. Ooh. In episode 6 of season 2, which was a emotionally exhausting tour de force. So yeah, it's also funny.
It's also funny.
It's also funny while it also is just like making you stressed as hell.
Megan's talked about it a little bit. Maybe it is something that we jump into. There's just like a lot of shows that we're like, oh, we got to get to that, or we should totally watch that, and then we sit down and we're just like, can't think of them.
Yeah, I think like because like it is a half hour show, so that is good, except for season 2, since it's all coming out at once. Like the episodes are mostly a half hour, but episode 6 was an hour. Oh. So it is a pretty quick binge, and I think it is you get really invested. It's very, it also has that Friday Night Lights like verite feel. Like it doesn't feel like episodes were scripted and performed so much as they were just caught on camera. Oh. Because, you know, it's a lot of natural dialogue and a lot of people talking over each other and a lot of like cameras in positions where it looks like they're catching things accidentally, kind of. It's really intense.
Hmm.
Just like life, baby.
Just like the streets of San Francisco.
I wanted to bring up that we did get a comment on the I Love Lucy episode this past. I think we haven't talked from Joe Cab. Said he loved the episode. I didn't even know you have a YouTube channel. We do. Go there. It's more visually interesting when I'm dressed as a woman. So, you know, mileage may vary. But guess what? Don Juan, the movie that Ricky Ricardo moved to LA to make, never got made. Metro ends up shelving the movie, but are nice enough to find other work for Ricky to do to finish his contract and keep them out in California for a while longer. Which, yeah, that seems right.
He gets bit parts around Hollywood, just like like in Pee Wee's Big Adventure. He's at the hotel desk paging Mr. Herman. Herman.
Got to burn off that contract.
Paging Mr. Ricardo. Paging Mr. Ricardo to the front desk.
But yeah, gotta love it. Gotta love Lucy. But yes, this week we are traveling to the streets of San Francisco on February 1st, 1973. The Poseidon Adventure ruled the box office. Crocodile Rock by Elton John topped the charts. And ABC aired the Streets of San Francisco episode, A Collection of Eagles. Ethan, you must have seen A Collection of Eagles before today.
Believe me when I tell you, I had not heard of Streets of San Francisco until we were coming up with episodes for this show, where we looked at the Wikipedia page for homosexual content in 1970s TV, which it does exist.
It's a lot.
And this one popped up as it was interesting, but also because of the guest stars.
Yeah.
And then when I started looking at the guest stars, I started looking at the regular cast, and it's like, okay, so it's anchored by Carl Malden and Michael Douglas, the Michael Douglas.
Yeah.
And the guest stars are Joseph Cotten, John Saxon, and Jamie Farr.
Yeah. Jamie Farr in it for a hot second. Yeah. I'd never heard of this show because, dramas didn't play in reruns the way that sitcoms did. And so growing up in the 80s and 90s, you just never saw old dramas. I mean, even like Hill Street Blues and St. Elsewhere are kind of like the two like prototypical doctor and cop shows that I knew existed, but they didn't run on Nick at Night. I think they might have run on TV Land.
Is that because, and I'm spitballing, is that because it's easier to sell advertising space for a half hour TV show than it is for an hour?
I would assume, because you can get more bang for your buck in a half hour.
Yeah, you might find more people that'll sit through half an hour of Lucy than for an entire hour of Streets of San Francisco.
I will say, so the one drama that I do remember Nick at Night playing and watching just because it was on was the fucking White Shadow.
Oh, Ken Howard.
I'm a basketball coach in an inner city. I'm a white professional basketball player who is forced to retire from the Chicago Bulls of the NBA after suffering a severe knee injury. So he takes a job as the head basketball coach at a mostly black and Hispanic urban high school in South Central Los Angeles. And that is like the one drama. I don't know why they picked that one. That's what, and it only lasted 3 seasons, 54 episodes. Yeah. That was the extent of my drama knowledge. So
it was well remembered. I never saw it because it came on before I was born and it only aired in reruns for a very limited amount of time.
Yeah.
But I am familiar with it. Just looking up Ken Howard.
Yeah, I didn't know Streets of San Francisco existed. And I think also probably because they did not make a 90s movie about it.
They did make they did make a movie, like a made for TV movie version of the show. But this was after Michael Douglas had left. So it ran 5 seasons. Michael Douglas did 4 seasons and then they replaced him.
They replaced him with Paul Rudd.
Richard Hatch, who did Battlestar Galactica.
Battlestar Galactica, not the winner of Survivor Season 1.
So they replaced him for 1 season with Richard Hatch, and they brought in Michael Douglas's daughter, or the character's daughter. And then for the movie, Michael Douglas wasn't there, but his daughter was, and Richard Hatch was there. So
weird. Well, it is also weird to think of, like, at this point, Michael Douglas is just Kirk Douglas's son. He's got a TV show.
And right in the middle of it, the thing that changed his career was he produced One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And he went from being Kirk Douglas's son to being Hollywood player Michael Douglas.
But not even for acting.
Not even for acting at that point.
Which doesn't come until, like, 15 years after this episode airs, when he becomes the you have a big, like, a mid-sized budget erotic thriller, gotta have Michael Douglas in it, like, this just Basic Instinct, Fatal Attraction, at least those two are enough.
Yeah, Fatal Attraction was the first one that I can remember being like, okay, not that I remember, but the earliest film that I can remember him being in. That was, I mean, he's done some great films. For my money,
and the Wasp,
You Can't Beat the Game.
Is
such a fantastic film. I really want to watch that one again.
I liked, Wall Street, he was in Wall Street, and that's the 80s, Romancing the Stone, 80s were 80s was his decade, and now it is interesting that in this episode of Streets of San Francisco, I mean, he's probably the age that Hank Pym is in the Avengers Endgame flashbacks. Because they flash back to the 70s.
He's older than Carl Malden was in Streets of San Francisco. There's very little premise. It's a cop show set and shot in San Francisco. So, I mean, that's unique in and of itself. Not a lot of shows were shot completely on location like that, that weren't LA or New York.
Yeah.
And it was an older cop and a younger cop, and they were kind of like detectives.
Yeah.
And the one thing that they don't talk about in any of the synopses is that they hate each other. The one thing I can tell you from, like, their relationship is just, like, Carl Malden is always giving Michael Douglas shit for everything.
I mean, at one point he jokes that Michael Douglas might even be the killer in this episode. He jokes like, you're afraid to roll up your sleeves after they find out that the killer will have scratch marks. And it's like, Jesus, get off his back, Carl Malden.
There's one point where they go out to eat and Malden's like, how much I owe you? And he's like, ah, don't worry about it. And then he gets really angry, goes, who gave you a raise?
Yeah.
Are you getting this money? Malden's ridiculously abusive to Michael Douglas,
who speaks like this all the time.
It's a very like film noir cop and a 70s modern cop who does the crossword puzzle and stuff like that. But this week on Must Have Seen TV, we're talking about the Streets of San Francisco episode, A Collection of Eagles. Not an eagle to be seen in the episode. It is the 17th episode of season one and was written by Robert Eiholt and directed by Walter Grauman. Here's how IMDb describes the episode. A green consumed numismatist plots to switch a wealthy collector's gold double eagle coins with counterfeits, using and abusing his trusting accomplices along the way. Ethan, how accurate is that description?
Completely accurate.
Yeah, that's it. Except they don't mention that those accomplices are people he is definitely fucking, and they are a woman and a man.
Yes, and that's why it fits in with this month's Pride TV theme.
Yeah, and this whole episode is very couched in the, like, I don't even know if John Saxon's character is queer so much as just a psychopath. I don't think he has a sexual orientation outside of, I want money and I will kill and use anyone to get it. He does not have any romantic feelings towards any other human being.
I have to say that when I saw John Saxon's name attached to this, it rang every alarm bell being like, we got to watch this episode. I love John Saxon.
He's one of those guys who he shows up in all sorts of stuff. And I'm always like, oh yeah, that dude. I mean, Enter the Dragon.
Enter the Dragon.
Yeah, that's where I last saw him.
He was in two of the Nightmare on Elm Street films. He was the villain in the pilot episode of the A-Team.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Well, but he did a lot of like 70s and 80s TV, just a lot of it.
He is like, you know him when you see him because he looks like a totally jacked skull. Like he is. So like his head looks like a skull with like hair and kind of a comb over on it and like perfect eyebrows. And then he is so buff. His character in this episode is not like a physical threat at all. He's just like, he's a numismatist or whatever. He's a coin nerd. So he's just wearing turtlenecks the entire episode, but you can fucking see his biceps and pecs like through the turtlenecks the entire episode. It's like, God, he is huge.
I will say that I am married to, I am fairly cisgender, but you know what? John Saxon.
I mean, I would fuck John Saxon.
Your mind.
God, I mean, he's just like, yeah, he's just, God, he's just a hunk of man.
he plays angry. He plays sinister. He plays devious. I have never seen him play funny. I have never seen him play comedy. You only ever see him play fake funny and fake comedy when he's trying to connive someone into doing something.
Yeah. I mean, so... That also plays into like another trope of this episode is like bisexual people will trick you. Like that's the other kind of conceit that this falls under of like, he's two timing. I'm just looking at John Saxon's shirtless pics in Google right now. Lots of Speedos. We appreciate this. We salute you, John Saxon.
John Saxon knew what he had. He was also he started out as a hand model.
Oh, like George Costanza.
And then he for a while he was acting. He constantly acted. He started out as a model, and later in his career, he's like, now I'm older, I will also model. So he kind of kept that going. He died 3 years ago. 2020. RIP John Saxon.
I got lots of information about that for, I guess, later. But the episode opens with the most stereotypical or prototypical or the consummate 70s cop show opening. That theme song is the definition of what.
As you see, great. It just smash cuts of different parts of San Francisco. There's no people, there's no characters, it's just
San Francisco zooming in. But then they also have like all these like striped line transitions, and it's like the street, and there's like the narrator who sounds like he's narrating like 80s G.I. Joe toy commercials. He's like, the streets of San Francisco, a Quinn Martin production.
Yes, it is a Quinn Martin production, known for The Fugitive, known for Barnaby Jones, the FBI long series that lasted in the 70s, and his only film, The Mephisto Waltz.
Yeah, so it is very like it's very cop, like you know what you're getting.
Yeah,
and I mean I'm on board.
Well, and it has a couple of shots where it's just the they mount the camera behind the police siren as the car is driving through the streets, like the old Naked Gun police squad.
Yeah, god. Well, and also I like they actually like label the act breaks with like the streets of San Francisco, act one, act two, epilogue even.
Every time I wrote that down, I had an exclamation point in my notes. Act three.
That's what it felt like. The episode opens with Jamie Farr from MASH. He was the cross-dresser on MASH. I think that's not a derogatory term. That is what he was, because he was just trying to get out of the army.
I think this month we are shining lights on various different aspects of the queer experience.
Yeah, like trying to get out of it, which is not gay people did not like it when other gay people used being gay to get out of service in the 1940s. So that is a thing I have learned in my research. So like. Because yeah, serve your country, motherfuckers. That was the vibe. Like, what are you doing? So Jamie Farr is playing a like small time criminal who has come back from Mexico because, as we find out, he's like, did he buy all these gold planchettes?
They're little they're unstamped coins made of gold. Yeah. I have how much they're worth somewhere here. But they're cheap. They're little cheap things. They're worth about $65 back then, $488 today.
Wow.
That's just unstamped. I did a lot of inflation
coin research.
Calculator.
Wait, so just the act of stamping them increases their value that much?
Yeah, because otherwise it's just raw gold.
Wow. Man.
Yeah. Or a gold.
What will you fix value to? He says, looking at 5,000 comic books. So we find out, like, Jamie Farr calls. So, like, the plan that we find out is John Saxon is a pneumatumatist, a pneuma pneuma guy. And he is trying to basically, like, scam. There's, like, a billionaire coin collector whose coins are just sitting under glass. And so he is going to switch out those coins, take the real ones, leave some fake ones. And he's going to make fake ones by using these planchettes from Mexico and stamping them.
That's the plot. He's not breaking any windows. He's not, you know, killing anybody yet. But he is that's the plan. And he's got two accomplices. One is Tommy. Tommy is played by William Gray Espy. He was mostly a soap opera actor.
Oh yeah, I can tell that face. Was he was he really gay? I didn't need to look all that up.
I don't know. That's a solid. I couldn't find a lot of information about him that didn't really look. And his other accomplice is Karen, played by Belinda Montgomery. She did a lot of TV. She was in Tron Legacy, The Other Side of the Mountain, which was something from the 70s. But he's playing them against each other because she doesn't know that he is hooking up with Tommy, and Tommy doesn't know that he is hooking up with Karen.
Yeah.
He's giving them both the baby, once we get these, we'll get out of the country. It's you and me all the way to Spain.
And so, like, the opening scene is of the two of them and
Tommy, yeah.
And John Saxon is giving Tommy an insulin shot because he's diabetic. And it's the most sensual insulin shot. I mean, it's almost like a stand-in for, I mean, he's penetrating him. So, like, yeah. Like, there's a lot of, like, facial expressions and a lot of, like, longing looks at each other, like, knowing looks, which is about all you can get.
Yeah, and 70s TV.
And
he touches his arm at one point.
I think he's got to give him the shot. Yeah.
Yeah.
Should have gave him a shot in the ass. but so why is he using Tommy? What is he using Tommy for?
That's a good question. What is he using Tommy? Oh, because he needs someone to go to Jamie Farr's Flophouse Hotel room, which he paid cash for. He needs someone to steal the planchettes.
Yeah.
I looked this up because I look up those stupid little details. Jamie Farr calls John Saxon and says, I'm at 207 Front Street in the Embarcadero Hotel.
Ooh.
And so I've looked it up and it does exist.
Oh.
It is in the Embarcadero district. It is one block away. Currently, it is one block away from the Japanese consulate. And about 5 to 6 minutes away from two amazing tiki bars, the Tonga Room and Pagan Idol. But it's an area I've been to. Yeah.
Is it a more expensive place to stay now?
Yeah, it's not a hotel. I think it's a bank now. I mean, at the time, he probably just gave an address. It wasn't like an actual hotel. But where they said it was is now like a Citizens Bank or something like that.
So Tommy goes and like Jamie Farr is in the shower and Tommy like picks up the bag and like gets all the planchettes out. But then like Jamie Farr comes out of the shower. And so this transition blew my mind because last we see Tommy's like got a pillow. And as Jamie Farr comes out of the bathroom, he like, you know, puts the pillow over his head and like pulls him into the bathroom. Cut to the next scene. They're investigating the hotel room, which has been burnt to a crisp. Like, I mean, like nuked. Like the bed is a pile of ashes.
Which is great set dressing. like anyone can set like, we need a dirty hotel. Fool. Then the next thing would be like, now we need it burnt to a crisp.
Like, God, like. It's one of those, like, you're expecting them to just, like, stick their hand in the bed and just pull up a bunch of ashes and they all just fall out. But, yeah, and so while they're there, they're like, oh, this is another cigarette in the bed thing. And they're like, oh, you know, they don't know it's a homicide yet until, Michael Douglas finds a stray
planchette. Yeah, that, and we see it kind of where Tommy's going through the bag and putting some of the planchettes in his pocket and he drops a couple of them and he was able to pick a couple up and then the other one just down. He lost one, but we get to see them yell at each other for a while.
Yeah. Well, they also find a gun, but the gun has been burnt up as well, so they don't have the serial number. And
when Carl Malden shows it to Michael Douglas and goes, put your young eyes on it.
Oh, yeah. God. And I also like Carl Malden throughout the entire thing is wearing a fedora and an overcoat and a lot of vests. And like he just looks like he's been pulled out of the Maltese Falcon.
And he hates everybody. He talks down to everybody. He's unpleasant to watch.
I think, except for the scientist later on, or the crime scientist. Like, doesn't he say, like, you might be a pretty good policeman? Because he, like, I don't know.
Yeah, after he, like, talks down to him, like, and, like, he keeps doing things in the lab, like, move over, let me do this. Let me take a look at this. So, like, he doesn't trust people to do their jobs. Honestly, the two unlikable characters are not the murderer, not the thief, not anyone.
No, yeah,
they are our protagonists.
Yeah,
completely unlikable.
Yeah, honestly. So, like, we then now are introduced to the Mark, who is what is his character's name?
But he's played by James Cotton.
John R. James, played by Joseph Cotton.
Joseph Cotton, famous for Citizen Kane, The Third Man, Gaslight, and my favorite, Abominable Dr. Fibes, where he played the protagonist. In one of, in 100% my favorite Vincent Price film. Not wearing the t-shirt, wearing Creature from the Black Lagoon today, but I almost wore another Fibes shirt that I have, but I opted not to.
But he's an old geezer. Oh, he's a nice man. I like him. He's an old man. He's a rich man, so maybe he isn't that nice. Who knows? And he wears ascots and neckerchiefs, so I like that. He also appears to be single, so maybe the character's gay. Joseph Cotton was not.
We don't understand exactly what his job is, that he is a millionaire. See, I don't think he's a billionaire yet. I think this is the years where billionaire was still theoretical.
Oh, yeah, the good multi-millionaire. Times. Thank you.
But he talks about like working at the university, and part of being part of the English department, where I'm like, you're not a millionaire if you work in an English department. Were things different back then? Yeah. Like,
the Barbara Hershey, what is her name? She's at the Montgomery, right? Name is Karen Pearson.
Belinda Montgomery. Yeah.
As Karen Pearson is someone from the English department that they sent over because he's working on his like memoirs or whatever. And he's like dictating stories to her and she's writing them down. And she wants the story, the book, to be more about his life and not about his wealth. Because according to her, she's like, everyone knows how you acquired your wealth. I mean, we don't, but we want to know about your life.
Being part of the best damn English department in the country in San Francisco. Yeah.
But so like what we find out later on is that, so she was sent to do this under goodwill. I mean, like that is all true. Like she was sent and she's his house guest. And then months ago, the numerologist, John Saxon came over.
Please just call him not John Saxon. He doesn't have another name.
Wait, what is his name? His name's like Hobgood or something. Hagopian.
Vincent Hagopian. Vincent Hagopian Jr. His father Vincent was also Hagopian. A numismatist.
When Vincent Hagopian Jr. came over months ago, he like saw this impressionable young simple woman. I think they call her later.
They call her simple at one point. Well, she could never do it. She's very simple.
She's very simple. Jesus. And so he basically was like, oh, cool. I can 100% manipulate this lady to be my woman inside. And he does it when the episode starts, she is in.
She's head over heels for this guy.
Yeah.
He promises that they're going to go to Spain with all this money. Costa del Sol. So we get this nice little chat between Karen and James. He just seems like a very nice old man. I mean, there's something. So we're talking. We're doing another calculation. He says that the coins that he has on display, the double eagles, the gold double eagles, are worth $500,000.
Mm-hmm.
So we're gonna play a game. How much do you think that is in today money?
I mean, a billion.
I'm sorry,
too much.
No, it's way too much.
Oh, sorry. Well, you know, 500, $500,000. So like 50 million.
It's less than that. It's 3.75 million.
Oh, really?
Huh. Yeah. So the coins themselves, 3.75 million.
I mean, that's worth stealing if you're just a lowly local coin dude.
Yeah, he lives in this like big palatial estate that has staff. Like he has a house guest who helps him out and a housekeeper, at least one housekeeper.
Oh, right. Yeah.
He's in a wheelchair. So he's kind of limited to the rooms that they show him in. But Joseph Cotton himself was not in a wheelchair. It's just this character.
Yeah, and so after that, like, you know, the cops, like, realize, oh, this is a planchette. this is a planchette. It's worth XYZ. They're, like, starting to get onto, like, well, obviously, like, this is something more than just a guy smoking a cigarette in bed.
And also the gun had the serial number filed down, so that kind of, like, clued them in that something was up with this guy.
And so then is when... what's her name? God, Karen Pearson. There were so many fucking names. Karen Pearson comes to the coin place and she interrupts Hagopian showing Tommy how you make counterfeit coins. And yep. Tommy looks at her heartbroken or angry, like a mix of just like, it's oof.
Yeah, and the way that, that John Saxon plays it off is that Tommy is just a guy to help out a little.
Yeah, which, I mean, he's helping out. But then to he's so sensitive with Tommy. It's also just like, I mean, not to trash Karen Pearson, but what are you thinking?
Like, she's thinking, she's seen those pictures of John Saxon in a Speedo.
I mean, I guess, yeah. But also, like, he... Well, maybe it's because we know he's evil, but it's just also like, man, he's so obviously smarmy and up to something, especially because you are living currently with a millionaire. But, whatever. I'll forgive Kira Pearson. She is a simple woman.
So he's minting the double eagles, which would come to each one is worth $15,000.
That's got to be.
It's $112,000 now.
Coin. $113,000.
A coin.
Jeez.
No, I don't know if the value of coins has kept up with inflation. Maybe it is more, maybe it is less. I don't know.
I'll tell you, I got my Miles Morales first appearance over there, and that's my most valuable comic. So
I hate you for that because I missed out on that.
Ultimate Fallout number 4.
I wasn't reading the Ultimate books and I missed out on the first appearance of Miles Morales. I got the first appearance of Spider-Gwen.
Oh, yeah.
Which is pretty good. And yeah. I found out yesterday that I looked it up. I have the first appearance of Silk.
Oh.
She's getting her own TV series.
Good. She's conspicuously absent from the Spider-Verse movies, which is very weird. Yeah. Yeah, so like we get to see a lot of John Saxon playing the smooth talking both of these people. And so, like, I'm trying to think, put myself into the TV viewer's mind of 1973. Is the subtext with Tommy blatant enough to make Mom and Dad in Idaho understand what's going on?
Yeah, I think it's obvious that they're a couple. It doesn't seem like, it seems like a very lopsided couple. Tommy seems kind of simple, like Karen.
He's simple
was
too. Yeah,
he's simple too. John Saxon's kind of slick. He can kind of take advantage of Tommy, but my guess is that he was with Tommy first.
Because he does even, I don't, well, I mean, now it's like I don't know what to believe with Mr. the Vogelthorpe.
Hagopian, the newest numismatist.
These weird, what is a Star Wars? But no, like I can't trust him at all. But when he tells Tommy, like, she's just a means to an end or something. I believe that. Maybe because I wanted Hagopian and Tommy to be OTP, but he kills Tommy. So, all lies.
He does kill Tommy.
He doubles that insulin.
If there's anything that that happens in between. Okay, so Tommy overhears John Saxon say that he loves Karen.
Yeah.
So he's upset.
Yeah,
and Saxon has to be like, no, it's just a means to an end. So he's like, oh, it's time for your insulin, and gives 80 units.
It's very like dramatic too, because he's like, that's too much.
Like, I wrote it down. Vince, that's too much.
And then he does.
It's a great line read.
But you know what? I mean, like, he's got to kill him because this is the witness to, like, this is how he got the Plachettes and also killed Jamie Farr.
Killed Jamie Farr. And the cops know that Jamie Farr was murdered and did not die in the fire because there was no smoke in the lungs. He was dead beforehand. But there's a telltale clue that Farr scratched Tommy on the arm when they were fighting with the pillow. So the cops are looking out for a guy. Well, they could test the hair and the skin, and not DNA, but they're like, he's a white guy with blonde hair, 30s to 40s.
Yeah.
They could test the cells.
And Mulligan's like, well, that rules out me and the doctor, who is a black man. And then he looks at Michael Douglas and is like, what about you? Let's see those four. It's very, I mean, it's obviously a joke, but it's still just like, God, he really loves fucking with his partner.
And it never feels playful. It always feels mean-spirited. It feels angry.
It feels like it would be just exhausting to be Michael Douglas's character. Like, even earlier when he says, like, oh, it's a planchette, and Carl Mullen's like, how do you know that word? It's like, it's used a lot in crossword puzzle clues. You've got time to do crosswords? It's like, God.
And if you want to see something completely a different side of him, the only other thing that I've seen him in is Dario Argento's Cat of Nine Tails.
Oh.
Where he plays like a very friendly, nurturing grandfather, just nice guy. He's completely different. So I guess you could say that Carl Malden has some acting chops.
Oh, yeah.
But here he's just mad at especially Michael Douglas, but usually anyone else who's in the room.
I honestly like the forensics guy. I'm like, he should be one of the leads. Like, he was great.
He was all through this episode.
I liked him.
Back to him, he's like, you know,
what do you need now? Okay, here's your answer.
They're like, what is this planchette? He's like, oh, I'll just walk over to my bookshelf, get a couple books that I have on antique coins, and I'll just pass them over to you guys. Bring them back when you have a chance.
I will say that is the most.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to Amazon.com/comedy-ad-free. That's Amazon.com/comedy-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I just kept thinking about, like, God, before the internet. I mean, honestly, better times. Mm. Wish we still lived in them at this point. but just like how this entire episode is built on, like, thank God we got all these books on antique coins laying around. Like, we can identify these. How much are they worth? It's just like, man, being a cop had to be even harder.
Just think of all the stuff that, like, just like, imagine you're a lab tech. And you're trying to, like, you know, fill your bookshelf with all the things you'll need. How often does, like, you know, coin values come up in your planning where you're like, I need a book on coin values.
Yeah.
I need two. Cause he had a couple books. They were easy to find. The bookshelf wasn't big.
A lot of coin-based crimes in San Francisco in the 70s.
I've never seen any of the other episodes of Streets of San Francisco. So you might be right. Could be coin crimes.
And you got to imagine with the internet, John Saxon would have been able to find, like, hookups a lot easier. Also accomplices, patsies, scapegoats.
What would John Saxon do with the dark web?
Oh, God. I think he's doing it. I think he'd be selling a lot of other things. Maybe some human trafficking, maybe. I mean, he is terrifying. I think, like, he's an intense individual in this episode.
Yeah, yeah,
I wouldn't cross him.
He is very intense. He played villains a lot.
Yeah,
he played cops and villains a lot.
What is next? And then
so act three.
Well, they find out that, like, Jamie, they, like, identify who Jamie Farr's character is. Like, don't they say, like, he had, like, paint from a Mexican boat on his boot or something?
Yeah, it was very weird. They figured out who he was. I didn't write down how they figured out who it was.
Yeah.
I think it had to do with it was the gun. They do the thing where even though the serial number is filed off, you put some chemicals on it.
That was wild.
Light, and you can see that. So they were able to link the gun to Jamie Farr. That's who identified the body. But they also discover there's another body. Are they linked? Well, this body that they found in the water has a big scratch on his arm, and he's a white guy, aged 20 to 40, with blonde
good
hair.
Good twink age, yeah.
Would you consider Tommy a twink?
I think he's probably a 70s twink. Yeah.
Okay.
He's thin. He's good looking. But like in the 70s, you're probably not going to get as svelte and twinky a physique or attitude as like the 70s. Even the twinks still got to be a little bit Marlboro Man. Like,
I'd say he was more Marlboro Man than twink. He had a big head with a square jaw and like long flowing hair, like a big just like thing on his shoulders.
Maybe he's an otter. I don't understand all these things. We do find an interesting. So like the thing that Mr. James is actually passionate about are his roses. He's been working for generations, crossbreeding these roses to make like red roses with like yellow interiors or buds or whatever the words are. And Karen is so taken with them. And it's just like, oh, this. And during this scene, our man is wearing a jaunty as fuck neckerchief and also kind of holding his little like snippers in a little dainty way. I don't know. I was like, this is another gay icon in this episode.
I you know, not knowing a lot about this show, but also knowing that, you know, San Francisco, even
San Francisco,
at the time, was considered
the home of
T.C.
Jones.
Yeah. So it's like, how many other episodes of Streets of San Francisco
there's more than one, because on that list there were at least like two or three or four. So I did love both of their wardrobes, though. Like Michael Douglas wearing a lot of gray suits, big collars, dark blue shirts. And I don't know. I mean, I don't want to say I find Carl Malden attractive, but like,
go ahead.
The way that he's wearing these like gumshoe outfits, it's pretty hot.
Carl Malden.
He's got kind of like a hot old boxer kind of look to him.
Yeah.
His nose is kind of like, it looks like it's probably been broken a couple times.
Like a Ted Grant kind of.
He's always like, yeah.
Yeah.
I like that.
I wrote that Malden is mad at Douglas for .. paying for lunch.
God. Man, it must be exhausting being his partner.
Yeah, they finish lunch, and then this also blew my mind. They go to their car, the cop car, with the radio that's parked there with the windows open.
Man, just 70s. Leave everything. Who cares? No one's going to steal nothing.
Malden reaches through the window and calls like someone on the radio. I'm just like, you're in San Francisco, big city, not a great, not a safe town.
Yeah.
And you parked your car with the windows open. Your cop car with the windows open.
Yeah, this is, how it goes. So then we get, they find out that the scratches belong to the link all that together. And Karen starts getting cold feet. Because our man, Jimmy James, whatever the fuck his name is, but he like inferred that he doesn't own the coins anymore.
Yeah. Oh, they don't belong to me. My pride is the roses.
Yeah. And she finds out basically like, oh, well, I've left, when I die, the coins will go to the university, which they will then auction off to like make money for the et cetera. And she's just like, also, she's kind of just like, this sweet old man loves his roses and I feel bad for him. This is a kind of like where we get John Saxon, Vogelthorpe, whatever, Hoggopian, whatever.
I was just about to get this.
Get his like villain origin or his motive, which is like his dad ran the coin shop and he grew up seeing his father like grade and value all these coins for rich people who would then leave and put the coins in plastic and never do anything with them while we lived in poverty or whatever. And so he's like, that coin collection is just sitting under glass. He's not even using it. I want to see the world. But do we buy it?
That's that. It, he's We hear that from James Cotton, saying that, I take that back. This is another Karen and Saxon moment. Cause I was going to say that once they realize that that someone's going to be counterfeiting these coins with all these planchettes,
yeah,
the police have to call in, but the only guy in town who knows coins, Vincent Hagopian Jr., played by John Saxon.
Yeah, very Columbo. They're investigating the criminal about the crime he committed.
So they bring him in, and he has all the answers. He is slick as snot. He is oily and just, he controls the room. He's great.
Yeah, I would have sex with all three of these men.
John Saxon, call me.
Carl Malden, Michael Douglas. I did have a crush on Michael Douglas when I was a kid. Just one of those, you know, didn't understand them feelings. Pop culture wanted me to. He was in all the erotic thrillers that I was seeing commercials for as a 6-year-old. They bring him in and they, you know, it's a tense scene because we know what they don't know yet.
And he's talking very smart. He's talking about one of the double eagles is a special one. It sold at auction for $22,500, which in today's money would be $231,177.
Jesus, man. So like there's a loss of a lot of chalkboard action in this. For some reason, I was getting very hung up on the like pre-computers. This is what they had to do. And just like Michael Douglas having to write, honestly, just like hundreds of numbers and like coin
the names he writes down. Well, they ask Hagopian who would have these coins. And he says, well, I could compile a list of everyone in San Francisco who would have coins like these, or it might have even been nationwide. So Hagopian leaves. So John Saxon leaves. And we later see. We got a scene in the middle where Saxon and Karen get together. That he demands that Karen open the case, and she's like, "Oh, but they don't belong to him. He's such an old, nice old man." He's like, "You better do it." He's very mean. But Malden keeps thinking that. He keeps thinking that the market is only San Francisco for these coins, and that's where John Saxon's like, oh, we'll get you a list of all the coin dealers who might have double eagles in the area. It was a little weird that Malden was only thinking San Francisco, like these people couldn't have come here from another town to do this.
More work,
yeah.
So, oh,
well, they have the list that John Saxon gives them. And they're still looking around, and they look and they see that they found out who bought this super rare double eagle, the one worth $22,500, and notices that that name of the Joseph Cotton is not on the list that John Saxon gave
him. Why would he leave it off?
Why would he leave the most prominent coin collector off of this?
Because he plans on robbing him.
I had to double check because I'm like, it didn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
So I had to watch the scene again. I'm like, oh, that's okay.
I felt bad for Karen. Like this scene, like she's so close to this sweet old gay man. And the scene where she's like locking the thing and she like mimes locking it, but she doesn't lock the case.
And like, she opens. Ugh. She unlocks the back door.
Unlocks the back door, and it's like, Karen!
But then Joseph Cotton tells her this sob story that he was given this rare double eagle by his uncle when he was a kid. He was 7 years old, and he got this rare, because his uncle was a coin collector, and his uncle wanted him to start this coin collection. And what does he do? He sells it.
Dun, dun, dun. Yeah. And then he becomes a coin collector to try to get it all back.
And then he finally finds the one coin that he owned as a kid up for auction, the super rare one. And he that's why he buys it. And that's why I think he's kind of like ready to just wash his hands of the whole thing, donate them to the English department.
Yeah.
I've stopped collecting. I'm only interested in my roses.
And while he's telling this sob story, we see John Saxon. For some reason, he's stealing the coins while wearing like a sport coat and turtleneck. Like he's still like,
he doesn't wear
dressed for clothes. Going in. He's like, man, shouldn't you be wearing? I mean, like, we're talking ski mask. We're talking any. Nope. He's just like, went to dinner and now I'm going to go rob this old man.
I'm going to hide this face.
No, absolutely not.
John Saxon.
My physique is recognizable no matter what I'm wearing because it bulges through no matter what. Yes. I did like that our Joseph Cotton is wearing a jaunty neckerchief, always love, but then also like a Ronald McDonald like crayon red sport coat. God. Oh, and this is where he tells her. He's like, you know, my real passion is the roses, and the roses deserve a better name than my own. And I was thinking, what if I call them the Queen Karen Rose? What do you think? She gets up and leaves. She can't handle this. Guilty. She has such a guilty conscience.
She leaves, and she's going to go lock the case and tell John Saxon it's off. She wants to be a rose, and she gets there, and the case is locked. He's already been there. He's already done his work. He's exactly. Swapped out the real coins with the counterfeit coins, and he is out the door.
It's what you knew would happen, Karen, the original Karen. But that's when the cops are our Fave-Odd couple show up.
And they say, you're a target. You're a target. He's like, no, nonsense. The coins are all in there.
Yeah. And then look at these. Like small, like stress marks or whatever. Would those be on or an original? No, they would not. Dude, you've been scammed. Ugh.
You got Saxon.
Yeah, Saxon. Oh. And I'm just imagining him with like Ashton Kutcher hair and like an air horn. Ooh. Well, and this is where this nice old man says like, well, she wouldn't do any of this. She's such a simple girl. Like, but go easy on her. She's so simple. It's like, God, she's an English. She's from the English department. She's here writing your memoir.
She's just a student. I also want to point out that my alma mater, Alfred University, the mascot was the Saxons.
Oh, so
I wish it was named after John Saxon, but it was not.
No, of course not. Well, now this is where they're like, well, we fucking gotta find this guy.
Like, yeah, so they said they get back to the lab and they're talking about it, and they say we need to see if Tommy was ever seen in the company of John Saxon. And I love how we're just swapping real names and fake names, because I don't remember Tommy's real name, but I always remember John Saxon's name.
Yeah, of course.
And they say, like, where should we look? And Carl Malden in this weird just goes, the bars.
Yeah.
Oh, they're gay.
Yeah, it's like he knows that. He knows what's
the
up.
Bars. Well,
he's visited the bars. He's raided the bars a couple times, but he's also probably raided the bars, you know.
So, ooh.
Yeah, I would like. And then Karen goes to the John Saxon's shop to confront him and be, you know, and he backhands her.
Like, and knocks her unconscious with a backhand
immediately.
Which is just like, she was out way too long.
But again, look at those guns, because he's wearing the turtleneck and you can just see his hulking out of this turtleneck. Getting his shit together, gonna hit the road just as Michael Douglas and Carl Malden show up.
His arms are like a bullwhip, that they're just like regular arms, but they
boiled.
Yeah, when you whip them out, like by the end of it, it's like it breaks the sound.
He's like one of my action figures. Like John Saxon has one of those weird, like little, like wedges on the back that you put your thumb in and you turn it. It's Carl Malden fighting action. I do like, so he like peeks out the window, out like the door from the back of his shop, and he sees Carl Malden at the front door looking in, and so he then runs to the back, opens it, and I don't know if it's because like the resolution was low. But you just see him like take his suitcase and hit a figure, and it's Michael Douglas. But I just thought it was funny that he opens the door and then just like clobbers Michael Douglas with a suitcase.
Well, before then, he goes back to the refrigerator because he still has Tommy's insulin. And he's going off Karen the same way that he off Tommy.
Which would it take? Would 40 of insulin? Would a normal dose of insulin kill a person if they didn't have? I don't know.
That's a good question.
Yeah.
Write us in the comments. Tell us.
Let me know how much insulin it takes to kill a person.
For purely scientific entertainment purposes.
Well, then we get a shootout, which you got to imagine in the 1973 is like, oh, hell yeah, action on TV.
And broken glass here and there. And Malden hits Saxon in the
shoulder. Yeah. He just falls down. And then it's like, yeah.
Karen is not injected with the insulin. She wakes up from the slap heard around the world. I'm just one of those like 70s TV backhands where it's like, bap!
And then she's
just like, my brain has shut down. I am falling on the floor.
I've never been knocked being knocked unconscious is just such a trope of fiction that I'm always like, how accurate is like the G.I. Joe method of being knocked out where it's like you get punched and it's almost like they're hitting a timer on you. Like you are now inactive for 5 minutes. You know?
Yeah.
Like that's kind of, is that how it actually works?
Face before. I mean, I've been,
and how long were you out?
0 hours, zero time. I'm just kind of like, we used to do something in karate class where, and this is probably abuse, but you would stand there with your arms behind your back and there's a way to lock your tongue, to lock your jaw. You kind of like push your tongue up against the roof of your mouth and it locks your jaw. And they would have somebody backhand us, forehand us, and just keep going back and forth, just slapping your face. I can take a slap. Most people can.
Well, Karen didn't do any of this stuff. Karen's an English major. She's not taking karate.
And if you want to see that in action, go to our YouTube channel where I just did the whole hand motion thing to show how I was slapped in the face multiple times.
And my parents were like, oh, you like Ninja Turtles? Do you want to take karate? And I was like, no. I'm glad I said no.
you probably wouldn't have gone to the same kind of school. Like, I took hits.
No, yeah. I mean, this is also a 7-year-old isn't getting slapped in the face, I hope.
I was 10 years old when I started, and I did not start with any children's classes because my dad wanted to take it with me.
Ah.
We, as a 10-year-old, I was in adult classes. By the time I was 11 or 12 or 13, I was taking hits from adults.
Jesus Christ. I feel like this is a very...
It wasn't just like a strip mall Taekwondo kind of place. This was just like, we'll also teach you like what a street fight's like. And we will also fight without pads some of the time. And you're going to learn how to land. You're going to have to. The theory was no one in the street's going to hit you harder than someone hits you here.
Okay.
So
preparing you for all those fights that just don't happen, but
I'm glad they don't happen.
Thank God. We don't know what's going to happen in the next couple years. Then we get the epilogue because, you know, she goes to like soft jail, right? Like, I mean, she doesn't get away with this.
She turned evidence. And
yeah. They're like, oh, going to
jail. But they're like, it's not going to be a lot.
She's simple. She was manipulated by this dastardly homosexual psychopath. Hulk, this hulking homosexuals
who looks good in a turtleneck.
God. And so they're back at their office, and then some, like another officer comes in and hands them, hey, you got these two gifts for you. And I think Carl Malden's wearing a really hot, like sleeveless sweater vest, like cardigan. I'm sorry, I don't have issues. And so they both get these little presents and they open them and they are silver coins.
Silver dollars.
Ooh, boy.
And
but you better believe they look up.
They look up. They're worth $4 a piece.
He's like, we're rich. How much are they? $4 a piece. How much is that in 2023 money?
$28.
Oh, I mean, hey, it's like two lunches.
Yeah.
Like Chipotle lunches.
I mean,
only if you get a burrito, not if you get
in 1973. How much would a meal cost? Because I remember, like in the 60s, you'd be like 15 cents gets you a burger, fries, and soda.
Yeah, they're eating for a month. They're paying rent. That's how that
Michael Douglas is like, just take it out of my coin.
Do you think people shipped them?
Oh, yeah.
I think. I mean, it's two men on a TV show. There are definitely some housewives in the Midwest just trying to figure out what they wanted to do to them.
I get the feeling that Carl Malden thinks of sex as something that just makes him mad, like everything in his life. So just like the idea of it is just like, God damn that sex. He hates it like he hates everything in his life.
What a man.
What a really angry man.
Carl Malden. Jesus. Are you ready for some must-have facts?
Oh, believe me, I am ready.
Some must-have John Sachs. So this episode of Streets of San Francisco was 26th for the week, ranked 26th, what must watch pro. But apparently that was the show's best ratings yet because it had just been moved to Thursdays from, I think, a weekend. So it was like that was good news for them.
Yeah. It was up against. Oh, you'll get to that.
The top five shows of the week were: number five was Maude. Four was Hawaii 5-0. Three was Ironside, starring gay legend Raymond Burr. Right? Yes. Yeah, he was Ironside. Telly Savalas was Kojak.
Yes.
I get all these confused. Just because, like, you hear Ironside and you think Telly Savalas. Obviously. Not just, you know, big old Raymond Burr. Whatever. Two, Sanford and Son. And number one was All in the Family. The ABC Thursday night lineup, which, I mean, really, like, knowing their audience, programming a night, Mod Squad, followed by Kung Fu, followed by Streets of San Francisco.
It's all action.
That's a night. That's a night.
Yeah, it is. I, if I was a kid who was, like, you know, into 70s stuff, I'd be like, let's stay up and watch all these together. Maybe not Streets of San Francisco. That's a little too mom and dad cop show.
Oh, yeah. Mod Squad. They were cool.
Mod Squad for cool kids.
Did both of these get 90s movies? What did Kung Fu get? Did Kung Fu get like a sequel series?
It got a sequel series with...
in the 90s.
Yeah. It got the sequel series with Carradine's son.
Okay, yeah. But I saw the Mod Squad movie, which was Claire Danes, Omar Epps, or Mekhi Phifer, Mod Squad movie.
And
it was Omar Epps and Giovanni Ribisi.
Giovanni Ribisi, that's right.
Yeah. And because I was like, oh, hell yeah, I like the Mod Squad movie. I was also really big into 90s nostalgia for the 70s in the 90s.
Kung Fu still has a series out too now. Yeah. They did
unless it got canceled because the CW is just a bloodbath.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff getting canceled. I mean,
and pulled from existence. So
support the strike.
Do what you must do to get your content and support the strike.
A pirate is always free. Wink.
What? So I have some information about John Saxon that is. I had to find out because let's do what are you watching first. So like, what are you watching on this night of television on ABC? It was Streets of San Francisco. Joseph Cotton, as the elderly owner of a collection of eagles, rare coins that are about to fall prey to a clever thief. On CBS was an episode of CBS Reports. What are we doing to our children? Which examines the problems of troubled youths growing up in America. Producer Isaac Kleinerman focuses on Atlanta and finds a 10-year-old boy arrested for rock throwing and sentenced to 34 days in a child treatment center. Children in a public housing project living on welfare. 85% of them are without fathers. Okay.
How old am I in this equation?
Well, and then on NBC, we got the Dean Martin Show. Laugh-ins, Ruth Buzzy, comic Lonnie Shore, and 14-year-old ballerina Lori Aquino. Comedy, a musical sketch with Dean and Ruth as a divorced couple dividing up their settlement. Also, film clips from MGM's Naughty Marietta, 1935, with Nelson Eddy and Jeanette McDonald.
Oh.
Age you are now. This is you.
Oh, no, I'm doing something else. Tonight's not a TV night. Tonight is a go out. Tonight is a see live theater. Tonight is a read a book. night. None of these seem interesting.
I would watch Streets of San Francisco, especially if they had done the job of like John Saxon's in this episode. Then I'd be like, yeah. Oh, yes. I would, honey, we're staying home. You don't have to watch. I'm watching.
So one of the reasons that this moved to a different night was it was originally competing against Mary Tyler Moore Show and the Bob Newhart Show.
Yeah, which is, so they moved it to Thursdays where it's against just random junk.
Garbage.
And fits in with a good lineup of shows. So when we watched, was he in Game of Death with Bruce Lee?
No, he was in Enter the Dragon. So
me and my husband watched Enter the Dragon probably in 2020, and he's in it and hot. So I looked him up because I knew who he was. And I saw that he had died recently, and he died in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, which is where I am from. So he died in my hometown. And I was like, what? Because was born in like Brooklyn. Like he's an Italian from New York. So how did he end up there? So I did research on figuring this out. And it's him and his wife, Gloria. So they actually moved to the Heritage, which is an old folks, or like it's more like a retirement community. So it's not like it's like lightly assisted living. You know, I think they probably had their own apartment and like, in 2017, rather than just retire in Los Angeles, as Gloria said in 2017 when they moved, I didn't want him standing outside in the backyard looking at the ocean all day. I searched for a long time to find a place that we liked. At the Heritage, they really have an understanding of care that you don't get in other places. They have more activities. We have 24/7 access to everything, and we can keep our dog. And in Los Angeles, the traffic is bad and it takes you forever to get out. We can go in and out much easier here. Which, and also like Brentwood is the nice. It is a very expensive. I mean, I never went to Brentwood. Brentwood was the home of the Cool Springs Galleria, which was the nice mall. So we would go there, but like going to Cool Springs was like a big deal. I do remember Cool Springs at one point, I think, had a comic book kiosk. In like the early 90s, where like someone was selling comics, and that might be where I got Gambit's first appearance on Candy 266.
You can find some really neat things. There used to be a guy selling in Union Square, and for like $20, I got a literal Golden Age Detective Comics.
Jesus,
where it was the issue where they show Batman's dad in the old Batman suit. Like $20, I still have it.
Man,
I still have all my comics.
I love finding.
Yeah, I do too.
So when he moved in, though, many of the residents at the Heritage were fans of his. And so two residents in particular requested screenings of his classic movies, and it turned into a 5-day screening of Saxon movies. And then they also did that again when he died. They had another like 5-day like festival of John Saxon movies that his wife threw. So and I think she's probably still there because she hasn't died. But yeah, I'm, you know. Yeah, I was like, why the fuck would he move to Murfreesboro? But Brentwood makes more sense because Brentwood is super ritzy. And also that Heritage place looks nice. I looked up the website.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I don't know how expensive it is.
John Saxon, RAP, but you died in style. So yeah. we'll give you those points.
Amongst fans.
I don't know. I've been a fan. I just remember knowing about him in the 80s and the 90s when I was growing up. He's in the Mystery Science Theater 3000 episode Mitchell. He plays Deany. His last name is Deany, where his character is in the first half committing a crime, and then halfway through they drop that plot and they just say that he was killed over like a phone conversation, and his plot just vanishes. But yeah, he's just one of those guys that if you see him and you say that's John Saxon, you'll know who that is.
Yeah,
he would make a great Red Skull.
Yeah, the buff hot skull with anyway, on IMDb, 136 Streets of San Franciscans. Oh, I also wanted to point out, I tried to find any fucking gay news from February 1973 when this aired in San Francisco. So I was searching all the San Francisco newspapers. Nothing. Harvey Milk had moved to San Francisco in 1972, and he was working at Castro Camera, which was his camera shop. And so I was like looking up Castro Camera, which they first appear in the news in late 73 in like October, because they're selling, they're one of the places you can go to get tickets to this like show that's being put on, which I'm assuming was probably a gay show. Yeah. And so I was like, just trying to find, and I was trying to find like reactions to this episode, like people writing in newspapers complaining, didn't find any of that. I tried to find anything about gays being on TV and people being mad about that. Didn't. So, yeah, I did try to find more.
It was very, I mean, it was very lightly gay content. It was not like this was longing looks, a touch on the arm, and a promise that they're going to be together. That's.
And it was the same as last week's, as the Alfred Hitchcock thing, where it's like queerness is coded as dangerous, like the evil, the bad person is like, it's there to unsettle the viewer. Like the viewer was supposed to see John Saxon touching Tommy and giving him his insulin. It's like, oh god,
I'm sure there were people in middle America who are like, oh, they must be very good friends.
Yes, they, that's his nurse. Yeah, so 136 people gave this a 7.2 on IMDb. Would you go higher or lower based on all of the other Streets of San Francisco episodes you have?
You know what? I would say this is a solid 7. I don't know about a 7.2.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't. Yeah. I mean, I think for a first episode, it felt good. I mean, I feel like I understand the dynamics.
It's long. Like it felt longer than the other long episodes that we've watched.
I mean, it's a 50-minute, you know, because back then we got more content and less commercials.
You can find it on Daily Motion. That's where we found it. There's been a DVD set released of it, but it's not streaming anywhere besides Daily Motion.
Well, and I think it's also in Holland. Because I think all the Daily Motion listings say Deutsch. And then I did notice that Robert Wagner was in the pilot, which was a 2-hour movie. And so I was like, well, I 100% need to see how fucking hot Robert Wagner is in this episode. And so I found it, and it's a clip on YouTube, and they're all speaking Dutch. It's dubbed, but you can still see his glorious sideburns and the leather jacket. And who had the must-see performance in this episode? I'm giving it to John Saxon's biceps.
I'm giving it to the John Saxon entire package, the way he spoke, the way he looked, the way he killed people. Just John Saxon
having fun, having a good time.
So this is probably where we should have said, if you don't know, we should have said this at the beginning. If you don't know John Saxon, look him up and look at a picture so you know who we're talking about reverently for the last hour.
He's just like you, like in the old comics where it's like the wimp at the beach who sees the dude with muscles and he's like, if I eat these sea monkeys, I'll get muscles, like, or whatever it is. Like, he looks like the after, or he looks like Flex Mentallo or whatever, right?
Yeah, he would make a like, great Flex Mentallo. Yeah. Just as good a Red Skull as a Flex Mentallo.
Yeah, I mean, like, Colossus. You'd need more of a flat top, though.
He wouldn't do a flat top. He always did the comb over.
Yeah, hot comb over. Must other people see this episode?
Yes.
I mean, yeah, if it sounds interesting from what we said, if you're into coins and Michael Douglas... Nasally Michael Douglas.
This was, and The Streets of San Francisco was a show that it was a guest star every episode.
You can probably find one like, that has someone you love.
Yeah, it wasn't just like, and the big guest this week, Joseph Cotton and John Saxon. John Saxon wasn't even a big star then. But like you'd find, you just go down the list and be like, oh, it's like Love Boat, where like every week there'd be like a new celebrity to interact with everybody.
Or like Poker Face. I like those kind of shows. That's what, you know, watching Columbo, and it's like, oh, you know, this one has that one woman. I can't think of any guest stars at the top of my head right now. But yeah, that brings us to the end of the 1970s. Journey through Pride. We do know what we're gonna do next week, unless, you know, just who knows what's happening, but we're gonna go for an episode of the sitcom, the 1983 to 1984 sitcom Oh Madeline, starring Madeline Kahn. Yes, this was Madeline Kahn's short-lived sitcom, which I am excited to see. What was so wrong with it that they did not keep Madeline Kahn's fucking sitcom on the air? God, like, it's Madeline Kahn. It's like the funniest woman of the 70s and 80s. Like, I mean, just
I think once we hit, like, once we get past the 90s, we're going to have to do a run of like shows that lasted more than one season.
These are fascinating.
Because we did Monty. We're going to do Oh Madeline. Like, Bosom Buddies only did two seasons.
Yeah. Like, we'll do all hits. But the next to last episode of Oh Madeline, episode 17, Play Crystal For Me, involves Madeline disguises herself as a flamboyant author so she can appear on a TV talk show with a competing romance novelist, Charles Ludlam, who is a man posing as a woman. Charles Ludlam is a bona fide homosexual, an out, like, a probably queer activist, award-winning playwright. So it'll be exciting to learn more about him and to talk about this episode with gay icon Madeline Kahn, like, with the flames on the side of my face. And and then it'll be the 90s, which, who knows? And then after that, summer baby. I can't believe it only lasted whatever. Ethan, where can people find you to talk about their favorite John Saxon movies?
Check me out on EthanK55 on Instagram. I've actually had people write in and say that they like the show, so thank you so much for that. And people like my t-shirts. So
yeah.
Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Jeez, people can write in to me too. God. on Instagram at Brett White, or my drag account, which needs to be more active, but I need to do things, at Barb Hardly. And please rate and review the show in iTunes. Please watch on YouTube and rate and subscribe there and do things. You know what? Do whatever you want. We're not making any money off of this. We're not doing this for money. So all the things that people would normally ask you to do because they want to make bank, we're not asking you that. We just want to talk.
We're not sponsored by anybody. We don't have to do commercials for anybody.
Except Acast will put commercials in these, so I have no idea. But hey, I don't know who they are.
They do? I've never...
Sometimes. It might be once it hits a listener threshold. But I mean, in the past, I have made $50 in 1 year from this podcast. So,
wow.
Oof, getting nice nickels and dimes from some of these. Anyway,
I have a fun question for everyone who's sticking around just at the end. I'm thinking of starting to sell some of the stuff from my collection, and it's weird stuff. It is comic books. It is art. It is things just like books, old books, things that I just don't have space for anymore. Right into the podcast and be like, Ethan, this is how you should sell this kind of stuff. I'm thinking of putting together like an Instagram account that just like post everything and sell it that way. I don't know. I'm playing around
tags. It's hard figuring that stuff out.
It is, right? I don't know.
And eBay is just annoying. The post office sucks. But yeah, everybody, hang out, say hi, do things, keep celebrating, and keep it happening.
Keep it real.
Keep it happening.
Keep it sleazy.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.